the long yellow lines. There are two books here that I can recommend to you. I don't know that anyone's going to want to order these books, but I'm going to recommend them to you anyway. One is called The Essentials of Forensic Anthropology by T. Dale Stewart, one of the people who helped train me in the United States and who is probably one of the most knowledgeable forensic anthropologists, as far as I'm concerned anyway. And the other one is Human Osteology by someone who's not quite so knowledgeable, but wrote a very good book with lots of very good little illustrations in it about how you can tell a left from a right and an up from a down, things of that sort. So I just thought, that's William Bass, incidentally. And this is something that if you ever want to work on an archaeological excavation here in Jordan, work in the field and dig, which is what this first lecture tonight is oriented toward, getting people prepared to handle bones, then I would recommend that you invest in this. It's not terribly expensive or anything, but it's informative. It especially tells you not to pick up skulls by the eye sockets. And I'm going to spend 90% of my time tonight telling you not to pick up skulls by the eye sockets. Okay. Now, I had an original 50-50 split in these two lectures. I was going to talk about how to excavate, and then in the next lecture, I was going to talk about identification. But people have come up to me since, three people anyway, and have said that they're really more interested in the skeleton as a biological phenomenon of sorts, and how to excavate is something that your area supervisor screams at you all the while you're in the field anyway. So they were interested in having me shift the emphasis somewhat. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to devote about one half, possibly a third of this lecture to a very skimpy introduction into how to excavate in the field, to just the various types of tombs you're likely to encounter around here, or the sorts of tools that you use to get this stuff out of the ground. And then after that, I'm going to turn immediately to the skeleton as a biological phenomenon. And then we're going to talk about how you can tell a male from a female, how you can tell what age this person was approximately when they died. We'll get into that at any rate. I'm getting ahead of myself. I have my idiot cards here, and I never pay any attention to them while I'm talking, so that tends to throw me off. All right, now, osteologists, on the whole, I think everywhere in the world, tend to have something of a chip on their shoulders, on their collective shoulder, because osteology has been largely ignored in archaeological endeavors around the world, probably because of budgetary restraints as much as anything else. But the fact of the matter is that what often happens is you find a series of tombs that have been excavated in order to get the artifacts out of them, and then the bones have been pitched over the wall. I'm not kidding, they are genuinely pitched over the wall. Nothing at all is done with them, they're simply discarded. In other cases, and osteologists pray for this because they can stumble upon them years later in the basements of museums, sometimes they're just stashed away and never even recorded. Or perhaps they're simply conmingled. If they were not conmingled in the ground, then they find suddenly that they're conmingled in the museum someplace. In fact, probably one of the greatest conminglers in history was one of the former curators of physical anthropology at the Smithsonian, Serge Litschke, who decided that you could save space by storing all the femora together and all the mandibles together and all the clavicles together. You know, so you can open a drawer and find 150,000 Navajo clavicles, you know, staring you in the face. But you have no idea, you know, what went with that. And it's as though anything that happens to a clavicle happens only to a clavicle, and it has nothing to do with the rest of this biological organism. All right. Well, that to me is really tomb robbing. I think if you go down and you strip the artifacts out of a tomb, even for the best of purposes, in order to analyze them as closely as you can and tell what you can about the culture of the people who put them in there, I think if you're pitching the people over the wall, you're missing the point. Bones are, in fact, from my point of view, and hopefully after tonight, in fact, it's mandatory, after tonight, from your point of view, bones will be the most important thing that are in the ground. Now, you can get a wealth of information about the relationship between a biological organism and the environment in which it lived by studying its skeleton. The fact that people don't generally recognize that, I think, is largely a result of the fact that they tend to think of bone as being something solid and dead, when in fact it's neither. It's not terribly solid, and it's certainly not dead. It's a living tissue, and an extremely sensitive living tissue, which provides, of course, support for you. God knows how you'd all be sitting if you didn't have skeletons. You can see it now, it's kind of a pleasing thought. And it also provides, of course, the muscle attachments for locomotion and for moving your upper limbs, for moving any part of your body. And it also provides a great deal of the red blood material, some of the plat bones do anyway, the red blood material that you need to rejuvenate your blood. So the skeleton is in fact not only living tissue, it's a vital part of this organism, and it's not solid at all. As a matter of fact, anyone who's broken a bone can attest to that, I'm sure. Well, so from that you can get it's a very plastic substance, and from that you can get some idea of how the environment is going to interact with it. If you live in an area of the world where there are a lot of hills, your talus and calcaneus, your foot bones, are going to look different from the foot bones of your brother, your twin brother, for that matter, who left home at the age of 3 and grew up in Kansas someplace. There is nothing in your environment which doesn't have some effect. I shouldn't say nothing. But there's no real force at work in your environment, no selective force, no adaptive pressure that doesn't have some sort of a resulting alteration in your physical being someplace. Even if it's just an organism like mumps, even if it's only temporary, it's still there. Well, not only that, you can get information from bones about the sorts of organisms, pathogens, diseases that people suffered from in antiquity and in more recent times. Now, of course, you're not going to learn anything about epidemiology from this. You're not going to learn anything about an epidemic disease because it kills people too quickly to have any effect on the skeleton, any lasting effect at any rate. You will learn something about chronic diseases. Not all chronic diseases, but some. For example, tuberculosis, trypanematosis, which we know somewhat inaccurately under the overly thin spread titles of syphilis, vegel, and yaws, leprosy, the anemias, and any form of trauma that might happen to crop up. Incidentally, malnutrition is a form of trauma. All right. You can also tell something about the morbidity of a population. You're all thinking you can tell something about my morbidity by the fact that I'm standing here talking about. By morbidity, I mean the history of diseases for each individual when you get them out of the ground. This has been possible since the discovery of a phenomenon known as Harris growth arrest lines. It comes under several different names. It's only visible in x-ray usually, although if you section a bone all the way down, or do an elevation of a bone, if you will, cut it all the way down its length, you can in fact see them. All it is the remnants of when, during growth, incidentally this only occurs during the growing years, if you catch one of the childhood diseases, chicken pox, mumps, anything, even if you only have a mild case, you respond to that as an organism. Your whole body is getting messages. Stop growing, stop worrying about growing, start worrying about fighting this pathogen. And one of the things that happens is the trabecula, the bone, begins to grow across inside there underneath this epiphyseal cartilage that children have instead of the fused epiphysis. And when you've conquered this disease, if you've conquered this disease and not succumbed to it, your body, of course, continues with its growth process. This is a little bit generalized, incidentally. The growth doesn't stop during a childhood disease completely, but it does slow down. As it goes on, that thin web of trabecular bone going horizontally across the bone is left. Now, of course, some of it's resorbed, but what you have there, in effect, is a record. If you take an x-ray, and you can tell how long the bone is, if you can judge by the length of the long bone, the length, the age of the child, which can be done with decreasing accuracy as the child gets older and approaches puberty, then you have some record of that child's morbidity. You can't say that line represents chickenpox, that line represents measles, and that one just represents a severe cold. But you can, in many respects, tell that this child was healthy or unhealthy, or that this society, if you have a large sampling of these, suffered from a large number of childhood diseases, perhaps an unusually large number. We're also aiming at gathering information about demography, about populations, the composition of ancient and more modern populations. And this endeavor has been given the probably somewhat optimistic term paleodemography. In actual fact, they have less of a hold on this, less of a grip on it, than any other form of bone studies done archaeologically. The reason for that is that in paleodemography, you can't just pick up 4 or 5 individuals and call them a sample. In paleodemography, you need a cemetery that you can demonstrate archaeologically represents a fair sample of a group of people, men, women, and children. You have to be able to demonstrate that they didn't throw infants less than 1 year of age down the well when they died, and that's more common than you think, rather than burying them. You have to demonstrate that they didn't bury women someplace else on the other side of the hill, and you're wondering why there's only 4 women in this whole cemetery. You have to be able to demonstrate those things archaeologically. You have to work in close conjunction with the archaeologists to get that information. And then, when you're certain of that, then you do the bone studies. Because what you've established there is something like a small population universe, if you will. I shouldn't say actually the word universe in archaeological studies means something else. I shouldn't use it there. But you have a representative sample, let's put it that way. That's what you need in order to do demography. Because demography is, after all, ratios. Proportions, rather, more so than it is what went wrong with one person, or how one person lived, or what you can tell about how they lived from what's left of their dried bone specimens. Well, you can tell something about fecundity, for example. By fecundity, I mean fetuses brought to term. They don't necessarily have to survive the birth process, nor, in fact, is the mother, I suppose, but fecundity is recorded in the female pelvis by scars of parturation. There are people who don't believe that this works. There's a whole school of people who think that J. Lawrence Angel, who does a great deal of this sort of work, is all wet. That, in fact, yes, you can say a female has had one child at least, and if you see a series of scars of parturation, that you can say, yes, this woman has had several children, but there's no way you can count them. Angel thinks he can count them roughly. And so the truth, as usual, probably lies somewhere in between, but still this gives you an idea of the sort of information they're looking for. The second would be infant and child mortality. You have a couple of sampling problems here, in that infants and children's bones tend to deteriorate in the soil much more readily than do the bones of adults. You have average life expectancy that you can get, and you can divide that by sex. The average life expectancy in ancient times, incidentally, has been dragged way down by a form of sampling error that's peculiar only to statistics, and that is averaging and not doing anything else after you've gotten an average. The fact is that when you say people in ancient times lived an average life of 23 years, everything like, God, 23 years, you're just old enough to vote, and you go out and you go down the tube. Well, the fact of the matter is that they're balancing that against children who die before they reach the age of 14, or whenever puberty was. Incidentally, puberty moves back and forth through history, we find, along with social conditions. In Rome, puberty tended to be somewhat later. In our own society, puberty tends to be somewhat later, especially in females. In very primitive societies, like the Kalahari Bushmen, puberty tends to be, on the average, I think, 26 months earlier, which is substantial. You can get the ratio of males to females. It may surprise you that there are always more females in the cemetery. I shouldn't say always. I should never say always. But there are normally more females in a cemetery, in an ancient cemetery, than there are males. Whereas if you could go to an ancient city through some time machine, pop out, you would probably count more males than females. The fact is that there was a very delicate balance there all the time. The two numbers were never very far apart, but women tended to die earlier. In colonial America, for example, there was a rule of thumb that a woman lost a tooth for every child because of the massive calcium absorption that would take place when she was forming a whole new skeletal system within her body. And, of course, the husbands in colonial America commonly went through two or three wives. That's not true today. They're getting their revenge. They outlive us by 7 years on the average. 7 years is just about enough time to spend all that money. Well, you can also get some corroborating evidence, hopefully, for some archaeological assumptions about class and occupation. This, again, is a somewhat tenuous field. This is, again, the champion of tenuous fields. J. Lawrence Angel is very deeply involved in this. He thinks that he can actually isolate certain types of occupation by the traumatic effects on human bone. Now, he's probably being a little optimistic there, although he has done it in court. As a forensic anthropologist, he has, in fact, gone to court, and I think one time he identified the remains. Well, he established a corpus delicti. I don't think he got a conviction, but he established corpus delicti because the talus and part of the calcaneus and part of the lower right leg bone, also some portions of the same on the left, and a few finger bones were all that was left of this person. She'd been incinerated. This is a little morbid, I suppose. But he was able to establish that she was a dancer. And that was enough for the court. All they had to do was say, it's adult, it's female, and the chances are very good that she engaged in some form of activity habitually, which put a tremendous amount of strain on that part of her skeleton. That was enough for the court to establish that there was, in fact, a a body there. As you know, you can't prosecute for murder unless there's a body. You can hopefully shed light on a wide range of ancient medical practices. Amputation is something I'm particularly interested in, but I've only found three examples of it so far in the Neolithic material that we were working on in Portugal. And I think all three of them were, probably surgical. We did find last summer a trepanation. Some of you may be aware of the fact that in ancient times they performed I was almost going to say primitive, but it's not primitive at all, a form of brain surgery. They didn't really cut into the dura mater, but what they would do in order to relieve pressure, let's say that there was an aneurysm or something there, they might have been interpreting this as spirits or rocks in his head. They might have been interpreting it as anything. We don't know. But what we do know is that with flint tools, obsidian tools, they would cut a square of the flesh out of the scalp and then scrape out a square or an oval, depending on what part of the world. In some parts of the world, they actually drilled and then cut between the holes in the drill and removed a portion of the skull. That, of course, if they just missed it, I suppose they had to do it again. But if they were in fact right over the area where all of this difficulty was, then they would relieve that pressure. And for example, in the New World, there are Mesoamerican Indian groups who apparently did this almost ritually. I mean, for a head cold, because when you find these people in these, and they had something like a 74, 75, 76% success ratio, survival rate for it, which is better than I think brain surgery had in the 1920s. But nevertheless, I'm certainly getting off the topic here. That's what I get for not watching my idiot cards. Now, burials are purposely constructed. And not only that, they're purposely constructed at a time when people are feeling most ritualistic, when they're right up there against the great beyond, you know, or at least someone that they know or love is. And so they're time capsules, and they're time capsules in which people have left very definite clues about the culture. That's what archaeologists have tended to focus on, and they've done it with a great deal of success. We're going to ignore that tonight. I hope that's not what you thought we were going to talk about. We're going to be focusing on the bones themselves. Not so much out of conviction, but because I just don't know anything about the rest of it, I suppose. So we'll start with a short discussion of burials and how to excavate them. As in any other form of archaeology, burial excavation is destruction of a non-renewable information source database. You can't put it back. You probably couldn't, even with meticulous records, you probably couldn't put it back in a museum the way it was. I, in fact, were a witness to that there at the Smithsonian when they took some of the human remains from Bab Adra, reconstructed tombs such as they had discovered at Bab Adra, and then reinserted the bones. And they wanted to do it exactly as they found it in the ground, and they had very meticulous records, and they decided that was a hopeless case. What they wanted to do was get the generic idea across, and so they stacked them in there the way they wanted them, finally. In some respects, though, even though, obviously, burial excavation requires that you be very meticulous, in some respects, you're better off than the archaeologist who's going down in a tell and really doesn't know what's going to come up under his trowel next. Because you know at least roughly what's down there. There are dead people down there, and there is a matrix of objects down there that will tell you something about them. You may not know exactly how far down they are, but if you're doing work here in the Near East, you're particularly fortunate because they have fairly uniform tomb types. And if you once you've discovered the tomb shaft, very often you can say, aha, an early bronze tomb. And the chances are rather good that you'll be right. Well, what this means is for you is that you can move with a certain amount of dispatch. And for that matter, you can use a couple of archaeological techniques that are frowned upon in fact, I'm waiting for Gary to frown in a moment back there when I say arbitrary 10 centimeter levels. I shrugged, he didn't frown. There are a number of things that you can do in order to speed up the process of getting down, for example, the shaft into the tomb area itself, or down the grave shaft if it's just a simple grave shaft in the ground. You might say, why bother? Well, first of all, let me explain that. A tomb shaft is by definition a disturbed locus, disturbed soil. It's not stratified usually. It could be, but you're going to pick anything up using that older technique of 10 centimeter levels, which is a good deal faster. What you can lose by going much more slowly, looking for stratigraphy that is almost never there, is you can lose the whole deal, because if you go home, back to your camp that night, and sit down and relax, you come back the next morning, you're likely to find that the thing has been looted. Tomb looting all over the world is a time-honored custom. Most of the tombs of ancient Egypt were looted by the people who dug them, people who came along soon thereafter. So speed is something of the essence in getting rid of the dirt in the shaft. I don't want to emphasize that too much because it just runs against everybody's archaeological brain, but nevertheless, you have an enhanced degree of predictability there, and so that enables you to move a little bit more quickly. Well, that leads me to something else, another point that I wanted to make, and that is that in tell archaeology, you always leave a certain amount of the tell there. Well, a certain amount, a great deal of it there. You don't try to excavate the whole thing, simply level a tell and have nothing but pictures of it thereafter, elevations. What you attempt to do is leave something for excavators who are going to come along later who have better techniques than you do. That's not true necessarily in burial excavations. In fact, in my opinion, what people should do, what departments of antiquities all over the world should do, is tell organizations who are excavating, now listen, if you want to excavate the cemetery here, what we want is an enormous effort on your part to excavate all of that cemetery in one season, or as much of it as you can possibly find, and not to leave any parts of it unexcavated. Because once you've indicated to folks, like in Mexico, for example, if you show people how to find an Aztec tomb, they're going to go out and find Aztec tombs, and the next time you come back and try to excavate something, there won't be much left. Well, so I don't think that a cemetery should be begun unless you have the financial wherewithal and the will to go through and get as much of it as you possibly can, as much of it as can be found. And that also harkens back to the other, to what I was talking about earlier, about needing, in order to do paleodemography, a complete cemetery, or something like a complete cemetery, a strong sample. You're not really interested in picking out individual tombs. Individuals don't tell you about populations, except in a very limited sense. You need large samples in order to do statistical studies. So there's a number of ways that you can divide up the types of burials you're likely to encounter, but for the purposes of explanation, I'm going to try to be as simple as possible. Let's say that one way you can do it, is that a burial will always be two of these two things. It will be single or multiple. It will be secondary. Oops. My students go through up at Yarmouth. English is their second language, and they're just scrabbling across the word. That must be terrible. Or primary. A primary burial simply means that a person was put in the ground after he died and left there. A secondary burial means that there was some secondary treatment to that person before he was put into a final resting place. It's very common in American Indian tribes. We discovered last year that it seems to have been common in Neolithic Portugal, although no one knew that. For example, decomposition is allowed to take place, then the bones are cleaned and then stacked someplace. You can find this in Sinai in the monasteries of monks there, where you have these big stacks of skull. Single or multiple is rather self-explanatory. Either there's one person in there or there are many people in there. Now, if you're talking about the sort of container in which these people are placed, the sort of tomb structure itself, you find yourself concentrating on something slightly different. Around this area, I think we have examples of all of these that I'm about to tell you. This is very general. There are, in fact, more than this. But you have a grave shaft, which is to say, a simple pit dug in the ground. It may be lined with stones, it may be lined with cement and plaster, but it's a pit that goes straight down, and at the bottom of that pit you will find one or more people. The second would be a charnel house, and I'm going to include ossuaries. An ossuary being simply a place where people are, a large number of people from a population, from a village, from a religious sect, from some group of people who define themselves as a population, are all put together. Now, they can be either articulated, that is, everybody's lying in there together, the skeletons are laid out much the way as they were when the soft tissue decomposed, or you can find that they're all mixed up. They can be purposely mixed up by the people who put them in there. That's often the case in American Indian ossuaries. You have chambered tombs. Now, chambered tombs can be entered either horizontally or vertically. In the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, you very often find that you have a shaft going down and then a small door going off into a oven-shaped little room. In Roman times, more often than not, especially in the areas close to the urban centers, you would find a horizontal entry. And then once you got inside there, you had a main area which is surrounded by a series of loculi, which are like little slots into which people have been placed. I think that in most of the excavations that any of you are likely to take part in around here, you're going to find that one of these three types is represented there. The grave shaft is, in some respects, the easiest to dig. It's excavated by simply hollowing out the shaft. Let's say that you're looking on the end. Simply by hollowing out the shaft and then properly studying, and then removing the remains that are at the bottom. Now, if a grave shaft is very deep, that's not entirely possible. You have to spread out and have a square, and you have to descend by the levels that I talked to you about. Once you get down there, of course, you're going to try not to come straight down on top of the remains, but the shaft itself remains probably the simplest thing to excavate. When you're excavating this, it's an entirely different story. You have to enter that tomb shaft, and probably the best way to enter it without disturbing the remains that are inside is to enter it the same way the people who dug it left it, which is to say by the door. I've seen excavations in which they try to remove the entire roof and move down like an archaeological square would any place. I don't think that's a particularly good idea. You see that the material that the tomb was made from very often falls in and crushes the remains, and you have all sorts of difficulties. Well, a horizontal entry tomb or a loculus tomb such as this one, or such as the Romans normally used in this area, presents some fairly specialized problems because you have very often burials laid in here at a later date, because you're working in very cramped quarters, because it's necessary to get in there and work, and because it's necessary to record the occupation, or rather the location of every single item in there, every bone and every artifact, before anything's moved. I suppose that's why people have tried in the past to go down on it the way you would any other archaeological square and simply remove it layer by layer. But I think that's proven itself to be a less than profitable way to go about it. Once you've removed the burials from the center of the room here, then you have a great deal of space for moving about and taking them out of here very at your leisure. But, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, actually. Working inside a chamber, I have found that the use of what is really a somewhat antiquated archaeological device is probably the best way to go about it. It's called a radius board. And a radius board is nothing more than a flat circle of wood, which has all the points of the compass marked on it. Now, once you're in the tomb, you set that up in such a way that it can't be moved or isn't going to be moved, and you orient it toward true north with a compass. After which you have a metered tape running off from the very center of that, which swivels on a pivot, and then you have a plumb bob and a tape measure, and you map the location of everything in that room with that radius board. Now, if you were digging in an ossuary, or a charnel house, where you have large numbers of bones all smashed in together, obviously the best way to do it is to dig the way archaeologists traditionally have dug, with a grid system. And the grids themselves should never be more than about a meter square, possibly less if you can manage it, because many of the bones are so small, and you're going to have to record the position of each and every one of them. The idea with any burial, regardless of how you're moving down on it, is to pedestal it once you get there. That is, to have it up on a small table of residual dirt, to remove the dirt from around it and to have it sitting up. This prevents accidents in a lot of ways. It prevents people from walking on it, but it does a lot of other things as well. It enables you to remove the dirt from it and put it over here without the dirt being kicked back on top of it again. It facilitates moving around it And when it comes time to move the bones themselves, especially if they're in very friable or delicate condition, you find yourself able to do it better. If when you're coming down on the burial itself, it's essential that you use nothing but a sweeping motion with your trowel. Now, this is before you actually encountered the burial. If you know what sort of a burial you're coming down on and you know approximately where it's going to be, let's say this is a grave shaft, then you're excavating a little extra area off to one side. This is where you anticipate finding the remains. And you're excavating an extra area off to one side. When you get down there, those remains will be lying like this. And what you want them to be is on a pedestal, like so, with you alongside inside a slightly lower trench. As you begin to work on this thing, as you begin to come down with your trowel, sweeping it in a horizontal fashion, if you have to make a probe, try to make the probe at where you expect the femur to be, that is the thigh bone. If you do that, if you're going to hit a bone at all, you're going to hit two single bones. I mean, there's only one femur on each side. It's also the largest, the heaviest, and the strongest bone, so you're least likely to do damage to it. And when you make the incision over in one corner, the initial incision, in order to move down another layer and to remove the soil. That way, if you're moving the dirt toward you this way, you don't have to clean out an area here and then dump dirt back on top of it again as you move it out. You always start from the area opposite you and move it toward you. Once you've uncovered the burial, it's rather like jackstraw. What you want to do is have the thing pedestaled. You want to have it in bas-relief. You want the bones to be sitting on small pedestals of dirt, completely uncovered, dust, and dusted off clean. That's the ideal state of affairs. You don't often find that people do it as they should, but that ideally is what should be done. Once that's been done, you have a number of measurements that you have to make in situ before you move the bones. If you want standing height and sitting height for a person, you should take those measurements beforehand. Now, you can estimate those later in the laboratory. You can get fairly good information on standing and sitting height, in fact, on stature. In fact, you can get it from just one long bone. But when the bones are lying there in the soil, you'll find that very often what has happened, especially if it's an adhesive soil, is that as the cartilage in between the articular surfaces of the bones has decomposed, it's been replaced by dirt. And the dirt itself, of course, has taken up the exact amount of space as the cartilage vacated. And so you have, in fact, an error-free measurement of standing and sitting height. Now, you have to judge that for yourself when you're looking at it. It may well be that when you look at it, you realize that it's been moved around by rodents or something else. But still, it's a possibility. It has to be taken into consideration, and those measurements should be made in situ. The next thing that you want to do is you want to sketch, and you want photographs. The photographs should be made on the flattest plane possible, that is, not with a very wide-angle lens, even if it means making several overlapping photographs and fitting them together later on. And only then do you begin to remove the bones themselves. As for consolidation, that is firming the bones up, if they're in very bad condition, that's to be avoided. If it's at all possible, do not put anything on the bones in the soil. Now, it has been done in the past. It's been done by reputable archaeologists, but it certainly ruins the bones to have anything poured over top of them in order to consolidate them for later work in the laboratory. The best thing I can think of to put on it are these two, actually three, plastic solutions that are soluble in acetone, called Butvar, Formvar, and Alvar, which are available commercially. And they should be applied with a brush very carefully to a clean bone surface. If you put any dirt, if you allow any dirt underneath that, it's there forever. Dissolve the stuff in acetone again, but it's a terrible bother. And it's not likely that anyone ever will. So you want to make sure that they're very clean before you apply this stuff. If it's at all possible, don't do it at all. Remove them as they are, package them up, and send them off to the lab. It's also important to protect them from direct sunlight. If you're working in a shaft, such as this one, and you have sunlight coming down on you, it's a good idea to have an awning over, not just for your own comfort, but because these bones, in some cases, have been under the soil for 1,000 or more years, and it's somewhat colder and moister down there. And if you expose them to the sun immediately, they're going to warp and crack. In fact, some people try to get measurements of the circumference of many of the long bones right there in situ, just as they do standing height and sitting height. The simple reason they're not sure that shrinkage doesn't take place, and that they wouldn't later on be offering bogus statistics if they took those measurements after the bones had been dried in the laboratory. And to avoid ambiguity, and for that matter, to avoid just a simple loss of information, a burial form has to be used. You really can make up your own burial form. They're often tailor-made from excavation to excavation. But a certain amount of uniformity is desirable, and certain pieces of information are absolutely essential. I'll go through roughly what you would need in a burial form here now. You would need an identification heading, which would include such things as the organization name, the Smithsonian of Andrews University. You would, of course, need the name of the site, the season, the date, the location within, say, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. You would put down the Matamah region, for example, and then any more specific address information that you could come up with, the area, the square, the burial number, any numbers that are issued by the digging authority there should be in that heading, and also the period, when you suspect that those people were put into the soil, whether they're Romans or Byzantine. Now, it's always wise, I did, to follow that with a little question mark, because you may find later on that the archaeologist tripped you up and said, you know, that wasn't a Byzantine burial after all. It turned out to have been mid-1950s Levittown or something. Well, after that you have the location within the square. That is very specific archaeological locating information, the grid coordinates, if you will, and also the depth and the level from datum. Next, you need the burial type. Now, the burial type is a fairly confusing little code. A lot of different people use different systems, and it hasn't been standardized as yet. But the first thing that you would want to put under there is what we mentioned earlier, the number of people that are included. You would also need the type of treatment they had been accorded. For example, were they articulated, that is, altogether, or were they disarticulated? Was it a primary or a secondary burial? And had they been, for example, cremated? Any signs of cremation are rather important. We had a question about Jordan and about the Roman army here in Jordan that they were hoping we would be able to answer during the course of the excavations at Lejeune this year. And we talked to Dr. Hadidi about it, and so we sent off a lot of letters asking people what they thought. The Roman army traditionally practiced cremation, and we had found several ash layers down there during the course of excavation on what we called the Saudi Hill there. And we were a little pessimistic, but we got back the information from the paleoethnobotanists, that it takes about 1.6 cords of wood to do a proper cremation, and that there probably was not that much wood here for them to just go out and cremate every common soldier. I mean, an officer, if he wanted it, might have been able to have been cremated. But they thought that we could expect to find inhumation, that is, burial. And so we were cheered by that. All right, still under the category of burial type, you want to record the position of the body. And this can be a little bit confusing, because a body is either extended, that is, lying out flat, as we in our civilization normally bury people. It can be slightly flexed, which is anything other than extended, if your foot, the angle between your backbone and your femur is off a little bit from 180 degrees. Semi-flexed is anything past slightly flexed, which is a nebulous category at best, and up to the point where the leg is running at a right angle to the angle of the backbone. Flexed simply means anything that can be considered in that category of a right angle. And then after which you have, and above, and tightly flexed is when they have the chin, or the knees tucked up right underneath the chin, which is common in some types of American Indian burials, especially in Maryland, the ossuary burials that the Smithsonian excavated a couple of years ago. First, they tightly flexed them so that nobody would expect to find them with their knees up underneath the chin, and then when they opened the thing up, they let kids run through kicking the bones all over the place. So the result was that nobody had a very clear idea of who belonged to who. You also have to record the position of the hands and the arms, the compass orientation of the head, as well as which way the face is pointing, but that can fool you, because during decomposition, of course, the skull can roll away. And finally, you have the position of the trunk, the compass orientation of the trunk, because you may find that people are laid partially on their side. Normally, if you do find that, it's accidental. I find that In America, the American Indian burials that were found outside of Washington, D.C., there were a dozen or so of them. Almost all of them have been turned partially on their side. It's pretty clear that they were originally completely on their side. But there is a phenomenon, the name of which eludes me at the moment, during which, during the early stages of composition, when the soil around them, of course, of decomposition, was very loose, the blood had a tendency to coagulate in such heavier, fleshier areas as the buttocks, and then the lower part of the body simply flipped over. Well, that was what they insisted had happened anyway. Well, next you have a category for associated grave goods, anything at all, and a map of those grave goods. Anything at all that was included in the grave with the body, from jewelry to pots. Then you have the grave type, which we outlined briefly earlier, with reference to any archaeological report that exists on the architecture thereof and the dimensions of the burial. Next, you have stratification in the fill, if there was any stratification, and whatever inclusions might have been found. You might find a couple of projectile points in the fill. The projectile points belong to the paleo, the upper Paleolithic or something, and you're a little surprised to find it in a Bronze Age burial, but still you have to make mention of it. It's simply thrown in there with the fill. Associated features. For example, you might find that the Canaanites had a habit of burying people under the corner of a house. That house is an associated feature. It should be mentioned in the burial report, in this burial sheet, because that ultimately is going to go into a separate file. And it's a little confusing for people who don't have access to all the records of the excavation to have information about the bones only and not to know such an obviously important thing as that the burial was under the floor of a house. You want notes on the soil moisture and on the climate in general. And you want notes on the surrounding geology and the foliage, if that's possible. I've never included that myself, but it's on the Smithsonian burial report, and they always send these little notes back to you. I don't even know why you didn't fill it in. Also, the state of preservation. This again is subjective and sometimes requires as much of as a paragraph telling them whether it's friable, whether the bones are very friable and chalky, whether many of them are broken. Do you give them a percentage of how many are intact? Anyway, something that they can go on. The completeness. Now, this can be more important than it seems. Completeness means which bones are missing completely. There was a burial that Lawrence Angel was called out to dig up, which was missing the entire lower leg. And they hunted all over for the lower leg. This was a fairly recent burial. In fact, it had been a murder. They thought that they had found themselves a corpus delicti for a murderer that they suspected. This was in the 50s that this occurred. And it turned out that it had in fact been a murder, but it had been a murder committed in colonial times or something. And there was no way that they could ever pin it on anyone. But with all the people they had in the docks there in Washington, it's a shame to waste a good corpus delicti. They tried to get something out of that. You also have the stature measurements in situ that I mentioned earlier. You have the sex of the individual that you've uncovered and the criteria that you used for determining what the sex was. You have the age and the criteria for that. You have such things as photo numbers, negative numbers, so that people can go to another file and find the photographs that they're looking for. Of course, you have the inevitable remarks column. And of course, the recorder's name and the numbers for the bags and later storage disposition so they can go and find the material itself. Well, I have a list here of general do's and don'ts about handling bones. I really wanted to get through this and get to the skeleton itself if we have time. And the first would be always leave bones in place, in situ, until the entire skeleton has been exposed. You do not remove bones piecemeal. You don't dust it off, uncover the femur, and say, there's the femur, okay, where's the bag? Take it out and say, now I know that everybody does this. I do it myself sometimes, especially if you're in a hurry, and the burial's in the way because it's intrusive and it's between you and something you consider to be more valuable. But still, it's a rule. We're honored to breach, I suppose. You should always take photographs and make sketches using meter sticks before you move anything, and fill out the burial sheet. Do not rely on your memory for anything. Even if the person who is supervising you there on the dig tells you that it's essential that we get this thing out of here and get down to something that's a little bit more important, architectural archaeologists have a tendency to do that. The anthropologists who want to look at that material later on will not thank you for being that careless, so you might want to remember this. Always, well, using the sweeping trowel motion, as I mentioned earlier, always place the bones in a clearly marked container. Now, that sounds as though it's fairly elementary, but it's remarkable how many skeletons there are in the upstairs of the Smithsonian, for example, that nobody has any idea who they are, or who they were, or where they came from. No one has a clear idea at all, because they simply weren't placed in a drawer that had a clear marking on it. And not only that, but the place is so big that you might not get back to looking for that skeleton until maybe a century after it was first deposited, and you find this little yellow card in there with somebody's beautiful script handwriting telling you it's lost, we don't know where it is, and then that's dated 1871 or something. That's the last time anybody ever saw it. You want to use several containers, several bags for each skeleton. This is a fine example of how not to do this, incidentally. So that they don't bash together and break. Here's a good example of breakage that's taken place since this stuff was in the library. You want to remove as much dirt as possible in the field, especially from inside the skull. It's a little dirty in there. The dirt that's inside the skull acts almost like the thing has been blown up like a balloon. There's pressure outward. And if you were to drop it or even give it the slightest bit of pressure, sometimes you'll find that the skull breaks into a lot of pieces, and what you have is a handful of dirt, and then all the pieces are down on the floor. You should always dry bones in the shade and not in the sun, and you should keep every piece that you discover, because you never know what's going to be important to the person who's doing the reconstruction later. Under the nevers, it sounds a little bit dogmatic, but I'll put it that way anyway. Try not ever to pry a bone loose. You have to uncover it completely before you move it. I know that, especially when the bones are in good shape, these bones are in excellent shape, and they're in very loose soil, and you only have a little bit of soil down on the end down there, and you're moving fast, and you're already violating the rule about not uncovering the whole skeleton, there's a tendency to just lift it out, and sometimes you're surprised, and it only comes off without the epiphysis down there. Try not to apply preservatives in the field. And lastly, I'm going to skip a lot of these because they're fairly elementary, and we don't have a whole lot of time. Don't ever pick up skulls by the eye sockets. That's really the only thing I wanted to tell you tonight, is not to pick up skulls by the eye sockets. It's just like a bowling ball, and it's very tempting, but the bone...